In my first presentation, I was speaking about Jesus in the heart of Israel. What I want to talk about now is more really about Israel in the heart of the church, but also a way in which the presence of Jesus in Israel becomes a concrete reality. I want to start by talking about the Jerusalem community of followers of Jesus in the first century. The Jerusalem community was a kind of prophetic sign of the Messiah in the heart of Israel. It was a concrete, tangible expression of the fact that Jesus lived in the very center of Jewish life. We see this when we read in the book of Acts about the way in which the life of these disciples of Jesus was centered on the temple. Over and over again, and I've provided for you on your handouts a number of these verses that speak about the way they would gather in the temple. Now, it's possible to think this is purely a matter of practicality. The temple had this large open space. They had a large number of people, and so they gathered there just because it was useful. Or perhaps it was purely from a desire to proclaim the good news in an environment where their audience would be present, a large number of Jews. But I really think that much more than that is going on. One of the clues we get is at the beginning of chapter 3, when we are told that James and John and Peter are going up, or it's just Peter and John, maybe just the two of them, were going up to the temple for the hour of prayer, at the hour of prayer. Now, what is the hour of prayer? It's not actually the hour of prayer. It's the hour of the sacrifice. The hour, and this in this case, of the afternoon sacrifice, the tamid. The sacrifice was offered at that time, the daily sacrifice that fulfilled the corporate obligation of Israel's worship before God. And we read both from the New Testament and from other ancient Jewish sources of how the people would gather in the courts of the temple at that time and pray as the sacrifice would be offered. And others would pray in other places who weren't able to be in Jerusalem. They would pray towards Jerusalem at that very same time. In fact, the prophet Daniel receives his vision in Daniel chapter 9 when he's praying towards Jerusalem at the time of the afternoon sacrifice. And even today, observant Jews will pray in the afternoon prayer called Mincha at the time of the afternoon sacrifice. So when Peter and John are going up to the temple at this point, they're not just going to proclaim the good news. They're not just going because it happens to be a convenient place to gather with the other followers of Jesus. They're going because the temple is their temple. The Jerusalem temple is the heart of Israel and of Israel's worship, and Israel's worship is their worship. They, the disciples of Jesus, are living at the very center of the Jewish world because that's where Jesus belongs. That's where they belong. They are as the disciples of the Messiah, the expression, the prophetic sign of his abiding in the very heart of Jewish life. And so later on, after Peter relocates out of Jerusalem and James, the brother of Jesus, becomes the leader of the Jerusalem community, it's significant that James has this reputation as an especially devout, observant Jew. He was known in later tradition as Yaakov HaTzadik, James the Righteous, James the Just, James the Torah faithful, covenant faithful follower of Jesus. And it's James who's speaking to Paul later on in Acts chapter 21, points to the whole community of the Jewish disciples of Jesus in Jerusalem, and he says, they are all zealous for the Torah. They are all zealous for the Torah. And so what we get this picture of is this community of Jewish followers of Jesus who are living in the heart of the Jewish life. They are devoted to the temple. They are devoted to the Torah. It's not merely an expedient in order to proclaim the gospel. It's not a means to another end. They're doing it because they are Jews, and Jesus is the risen Jewish Messiah and continues to dwell in the heart of Israel, and they live in the heart of Israel as the expression of that truth. Now, as we read through the book of Acts, we see that the drama of the book is about the way this community of faithful Jews opens itself up and receives into its midst those from the nations of the world who are joined to the Jewish people, who become part of this extended reality of the people of Israel without becoming Jews. This is the drama of the book. What we need to see is those Jews never cease to be Jews. And the Gentiles, when they are brought in, they are brought in as Gentiles, but they are brought in as Gentiles who are observing the elements of the Torah that apply to them. First of all, let's just take a moment and consider the dream or the vision that the Apostle Peter has, this famous vision in Acts chapter 10. Peter sees this sheet with all of these animals in it, and a voice says to him, "Rise, Peter, kill and eat." And Peter says, "Lord, I can't do that. I've never eaten anything impure or common. I'm not going to start now." Three times the vision is repeated. Three times Peter says, "Uh-uh, no." Which is, that in itself is rather striking. Not just that Peter says that he had never eaten anything unkosher, but that despite having a heavenly voice speak to him and say, "Do this," he says, "No, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do that. It can't be right. I don't care if it's a heavenly voice." You know, Torah says, I can't do that. I can't do it. And as a result of that, it says, afterwards, he pondered. What could this mean? What does this vision mean? Now, why is it say that? It says it because he knows it couldn't mean that God is simply saying, you Jews should stop eating according to the laws of Kashrut. Peter assumes, of course it doesn't mean that, and he assumes that. It's clear from his response to the vision that he doesn't do what he's told. And so as he's asking the question, what does it mean? What does the vision mean? It's a little bit like Daniel. Daniel receives the vision in Daniel 9, and then he's, what does it mean? And then he gets the interpretation. What is the interpretation comes when the men sent from Cornelius arrive at his doorstep at that very moment. And then the text says the Spirit tells him, go to them. When he goes to them and when he begins to speak to them, he says, God has shown me that I should not call any man impure or common. In other words, he understands the meaning of the vision. The meaning of the vision is that the kind of distinction that he's made in the past between the Jewish people who are holy, who are kadosh, and who are pure, and those who are not Jews, who are not holy, they're chol, they're profane or secular, and many of them would be then seen as morally impure, as in bondage to idolatry, that Peter is being told by this vision, those categories no longer work. You can't look at these non-Jews in that way, because I'm doing something brand new. And then he shows them what he's doing, because when he proclaims the gospel, when Peter announces Jesus to them, the Spirit of God is poured out from on high before they've been baptized, and of course without them being circumcised. And the Spirit of God, Peter says, came and purified their hearts. And therefore, Peter knows he's had now a demonstration of the very thing that he saw within his vision. You know that, and this is what rise, Peter, kill and eat meant. It didn't mean kill and eat unkosher food. It meant receive into your midst and into your life, into your family, the family of the community of the disciples of Yeshua, those from the nations whom I'm joining to myself. The great English biblical scholar Richard Baucom writes about this. He says, what Peter learns is that Gentiles who come to faith in Jesus Christ are neither impure nor profane. This is the lesson of his vision and of the Spirit's direction to him when he says not to make a distinction between Jews and Gentiles, between the holy people and the profane people. So that's the first stage. But of course, when we're reading in the book of Acts, we realize this doesn't settle things. A controversy erupts. And we read that many of these very zealous Torah-observant Jews in the community of Jerusalem are saying, these Gentiles, if they're going to really be fully part of the people of God, they've got to be circumcised. They've got to observe the whole Torah. What are we doing here? And eventually it leads to the Jerusalem Council in Acts chapter 15. And the resolution of matters in the Jerusalem Council is what is often called the apostolic decree. The apostolic decree. And it's found in a couple of different places, but if we look at Acts 15, verses 19 through 21, we read, and this is now it's interesting, it's James who gives this ruling. You know, Peter gives his testimony and argument, but the conclusion is reached by the leader of the Jerusalem community, the most Torah observant and pious of all of them. It's almost like it had to be him. You know, he was the one who could do this because his zeal for the Torah was unquestioned. And so he could come up with the ruling. And he does. He says, therefore, I have reached the decision that we should not trouble those Gentiles who are turning to God, but we should write to them to abstain only from things polluted by idols and from fornication and from whatever has been strangled and from blood. Four things, and these four things get repeated later on in verses 28 through 29. This is what's known as the apostolic decree. Now, the tendency is for Christians to see these verses as a merely pragmatic gesture, as these necessary things that, in a sense, Gentiles need to do as a concession to the somewhat scrupulous consciences of these excessively Torah-observant Jews. That they're not important in themselves. If, in fact, there are no Jews around, there wouldn't be any reason why Christians would need to do this. And when, in fact, the church in Jerusalem is no more, and there is no longer any visible Jewish community of disciples of Yeshua, then these prescriptions no longer have any point to them. That interpretation really has largely fallen by the wayside among serious scholars of this text. The tendency these days, it's not a universal consensus, but it's the general tendency, I would say, among biblical scholars, is to understand the apostolic decree as a summary of teachings that are found in Leviticus chapters 17 and 18. In Leviticus 17 and 18, we have, first in verse 7, the prohibition of sacrificing to a goat demons, in other words, to idols. A prohibition then in the following verses of consuming blood. And that is actually at the heart of the teaching in Leviticus 17, is this prohibition of consuming blood, because the life is in the blood, and the blood therefore belongs to God, and it is a kind of profaning of something holy to consume blood. And so we have the prohibition of consuming blood in the following verses. Then in verse 15 of chapter 17, there is prohibition of eating animals which die of themselves or are torn by wild animals. The point of that is that animals that die of themselves or who are killed by other animals are not slaughtered in a way that allows their blood to be drained out of them. In that sense, it's the equivalent of an animal being killed by being strangled. That's the problem with strangling. The problem with killing an animal by strangling them, according to Jewish law, is that it does not allow the blood to drain out of the animal properly. And then, in chapter 18 of Leviticus, the entire chapter is about the laws of sexual morality. So what we have here are these four laws. And at the end of chapter 18, there's an emphasis on the fact that the laws, particularly of sexual morality, but many think that it also applies to the laws of Leviticus 17, in some sense apply beyond just the realm of the Jewish people. We see that because it says that because of these things, the Gentile nations of Canaan are being expelled from the land. The land is vomiting them out because they have violated these things. Finally, there's a phrase that gets repeated in Leviticus 17 and 18 in connection with all four of these practices. And it says that these practices are prohibited not only from Israel, but from the stranger who dwells in their midst, from the ger, the gerim, who dwell in the midst of Israel. I think what's going on, and it's not just that I think, many biblical scholars now would say, is that there's an interpretation being given of this phrase then, the ger, the stranger who dwells in the midst of Israel, as a description of these Gentiles who are entering into the life of the church, of the community, of the disciples of Jesus. They are now dwelling in the midst of Israel. They're not Jews. They're gerim, but they're dwelling in the midst of Israel. And because of that, they are now part of the holy people, and therefore they need to live a holy life. And these four things define the kind of crucial basic reality that determine whether or not they are living in the holiness and can be part of the holy people of God. That gives a very different character to the apostolic decree. Richard Baucom writes this about the apostolic decree. All the evidence suggests that the apostolic decree was generally accepted by Jewish Christians as authoritatively defining the relation of Gentile believers to the law of Moses. They did not think this meant abolishing the law, as some supposed was Paul's teaching. They understood it to be upholding the validity of the law, which itself distinguished between Jews, who were to keep the whole law, and Gentile members of the eschatological people of God, on whom it laid only the four obligations specified in the decree. So this was not a kind of testimony to the fact that the law had been nullified or abolished. It was actually a way of affirming the Torah and saying, we are going to apply to the Gentiles in our midst those things that the Torah itself applies to such people. That then makes sense of what James says immediately after the enunciating the apostolic decree. In verse 21, he says, for in every city for generations past, Moses has had those who proclaim him, for he has been read aloud every Sabbath in the synagogues. What he's saying there is then, we're not saying here anything other than what the Torah, which is read every week in the synagogue itself, says. Any Gentiles anywhere in the world who want to go to the synagogue and hear the Torah, just make sure you're there when Leviticus 17 and 18 is read, and you'll hear these things. Nothing new. One final comment on the apostolic decree. I wanted to just read another Richard Baucom quote where he makes this point very clearly that this is not a matter of practical requirements for Gentiles having relationships with Jews. It is important to note that the reason the apostolic decree facilitates Jewish and Gentile table fellowship is not because three of its four prohibitions concern meat. As we have observed already, it would be easy enough for Jews sharing even a meal provided by Gentiles to observe these prohibitions by simply not eating meat. The first three practices forbidden by the decree, like the fourth, are not matters of ritual, but of moral purity. Moral purity, not ritual purity. The danger of table fellowship with Gentiles was of becoming implicated in these idolatrous and immoral practices of the Gentiles. Their prohibition to Gentiles in the apostolic decree, as in Leviticus itself, has the secondary effect of making close association of Jews and Gentiles who observe the prohibition possible. So it does facilitate it. But they are prohibited primarily because they are pollutions of which all the people of God, Jewish and Gentile, must be free. Now, regarding the Jerusalem Council and the controversy which produced it, there's a question that very few people until rather relatively recently have never asked. The question is actually a very simple one. What is it that both parties in the dispute presume? What is there that is not a point of controversy? You have one Jewish party that says the Gentiles have to keep the Torah. You have another Jewish party that says they don't have to keep the entire Torah or become Jews. They only need to keep a limited number of commandments. What is it that both parties assume to the point where it doesn't even have to be discussed? It is that the Jewish members of the community are keeping the Torah. That's not a matter of dispute. The person who really pointed this out most clearly was actually an Orthodox Jewish theologian, one of the great Jewish theologians of the latter part of the 20th century, Michael Visegrad. He wrote, "It is clear that both parties agreed that circumcision and Torah obedience remained obligatory for Jewish Jesus believers, since if this were not the case, one could hardly debate whether circumcision and Torah obedience were obligatory for Gentiles. Such a debate could only arise if both parties agreed on the lasting significance of the Mosaic law for Jews. Where they differed was its applicability to Gentiles." Now, the reason this is so significant is that when we realize that what was going on in the early church is this opening up to Gentiles, but in a way that involved a different set of expectations about how the Gentiles were going to be living out the Torah and the way in which Jews were doing it. What that implies is that the community itself has a kind of twofold character. You see, the Torah is not something that's lived out in private. The Torah is not a matter of private piety. It is a corporate reality. It is lived out in community. If the Torah is still something that Jewish disciples of Jesus are supposed to live, they have to do it together with other Jews. And what that means is you're going to have some environments which are primarily Gentile environments, such as the ones that are communities formed by Paul in the diaspora. And you're going to have some communities which are primarily Jewish environments, such as the Jerusalem community of this Jewish disciples of Jesus. What that results in is what I've called a fancy theological term, bilateral ecclesiology, an understanding that the body of Messiah has a twofold character, and that there needs to be a Jewish expression, a corporate Jewish expression of life in the midst of the church. The reason I think theologically this is the case is related to our first presentation. It's because the community of Jewish disciples of Jesus are the concrete demonstration both of the fact that Jesus lives in the heart of Israel, but also of the fact that in Jesus, Israel lives in the heart of the church. It's not meant to be a purely hidden, mysterious reality. There's supposed to be a visible sign of this truth. And the community of the Jewish followers of Jesus was that visible sign in the first century church. Now, one of the remarkable things in the book of Acts is that we see this even in the life of Paul himself. You know, I've been talking up to this point simply about the Jerusalem community and James. But what about Paul? Well, our image of Paul has been so formed by a picture of him as someone who was himself opposed to the Torah, as someone who taught everyone that the Torah no longer applied as a result of the coming of Jesus, and of course as someone who did not observe the Torah himself. But of course, the picture we get of Paul in Acts of the Apostles is the exact opposite of that. Of course, the key chapter, I've already referred to it, is Acts chapter 21. In Acts chapter 21, Paul has a meeting with James in Jerusalem. And James is speaking to Paul and saying, "You know, brother Paul, we have a problem here. We have a problem." In verse 20, it says, "You see, brother, how many thousands of believers there are among the Jews, and they're all zealous for the Torah. That's not the problem. The problem is this. They've been told about you that you teach all the Jews living among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, and that you tell them not to circumcise their children or observe the customs. This is a problem." Now, of course, most Christians in the past would read those verses and they'd be shaking their heads. They'd say, "Yeah, that's what Paul taught. Of course, that's what Paul taught." And then, of course, they scratch their heads at the next verse when James says, "Well, what's to be done? They'll certainly hear that you have come, so do what we tell you." And then he says, "Go and help a set of our people fulfill a vow at the temple," which means basically pay for the offering of sacrifice, and be involved in this very public Jewish rite. And the point is, James says, "Thus all will know that there is nothing in what they have been told about you, but that you yourself observe and guard the Torah." Now, again, according to the way in which Paul has been understood in the past, people would think, "Oh, Paul would never do something like this. This is to violate his conscience." But of course, Paul goes and does it. And so then sometimes the interpretation is, Paul is just being pragmatic. Paul, he's fudging a little, we'd say in English. He's just kind of, doing what he needs to do to get by. But that means Paul is actually being dishonest. Is that really what Paul was doing? Paul, of course, does this. And then a mistake ensues. He's accused of bringing a Gentile into the temple. And he gets arrested. Now, in the rest of the book of Acts, we have a number of scenes in which Paul appears in trials. in which he gives his defense. And time after time, the refrain that we hear over and over and over again is, I have done nothing against my people or the customs of my people. He repeats it over and over again. And the point is, he's saying, I did what James recommended that I do because I believed it. It was true. It was a lie they were telling about me. I don't teach that Jews should forsake the Torah. I teach that Gentiles are not required to be circumcised and to keep all of the laws that are incumbent upon Jews. That's what I teach. And that's been misunderstood. So even Paul, according to the book of Acts, is upholding this sense that there's a twofold reality in the life of the community of the disciples of Jesus. Now, this is beautiful when we look at the book of Acts. It works perfectly with the understanding of Israel Christology that I was talking about in the first session. Jesus in the heart of Israel, Israel in the heart of the church. But what happens? Well, what happens historically, of course, is really just a tragedy. The Jewish disciples of Jesus had opened up the body of Messiah to the Gentiles. But as soon as Jerusalem had been destroyed and there was no Jerusalem community at the very center of the life of the church, by the time we get into the second century and we have a community primarily of Gentiles, the door is shut in the face of Jews who seek to live as Jews. You know, when we are reading the writings of Justin Martyr in the middle part of the second century, he's asked, is it possible for Jews to observe the Torah and believe in Jesus and be saved? Now, you've come a long way in 100 years. You know, from the question was, could the Gentiles be saved without keeping the Torah? And now the question is, can these Jews be saved if they keep the Torah? Justin was very broad-minded. He says, well, there are many who say they can't be saved, but I'm not among them. Of course, I think they should be discouraged from this, and it's really not the best thing, but I think they'll be saved. Well, Justin's position, that more liberal position, wasn't the one that obtained as time went on. By the time you get to the 8th century, a church council rules that all Jews who are baptized need to renounce all Jewish practices. By the time you get to the period of Thomas Aquinas, it's defined as a mortal sin for a Jew who is baptized to observe the Sabbath or to keep the dietary laws or to light candles on Friday night. And of course, that has deadly consequences in the period of the Inquisition in Spain, when Jews who had been baptized and continued to do these practices were actually put to the flame. For over 18 centuries, the presence of Jesus in the heart of Israel and Israel in the heart of the church, this concrete sign of this truth, becomes an obscure, hidden reality without any concrete, prophetic, visible sign. I believe it's still a reality. Jesus is so bound up with the Jewish people that he continues and has continued in their midst. I believe that because of that unity that Jesus has with Israel, when Jesus lives in the heart of the church, Israel's in the heart of the church. You can't have one without the other. The risen Messiah is a Jew. He's the king of the Jews, and he brings the Jews right along with him. But it's been an obscured reality, a hidden reality. The emergence of the Messianic Jewish movement is an opportunity for the church, an opportunity to make this obscure reality visible, to bring it to concrete expression, to restore this visible sign that was so present in the church of the first century. I talked about coincidences in my first presentation. Is it a coincidence that in the 20th century we have the restoration of the Jewish people to the land of Israel? And at the very same time, we have the beginning of the Messianic Jewish movement and the restoration of a Jewish presence in the life of the church, the life and the restoration of a Jesus-believing presence in the midst of the Jewish people. I think it's no coincidence. It's a providential action of God. What this means, I believe, is that there's an opportunity for the church, an opportunity for the Jewish people. The church is the place, though, where it should be seized upon first. To seize upon this, to encourage this reality, to recognize that the Messianic Jewish reality is a concrete prophetic sign of this fundamental truth that we have to grasp if we're to fully grasp who Jesus is. This truth that Jesus lives in the heart of Israel and that Israel lives in the heart of the church. Thank you.